succession number 28750, Reel 2.
Laurie Manton, Reel 2.
One of the interesting things there is that the fact that the Americans in the UK, they drew their dead back to Cambridgeshire and places like where they had these great big American service cemeteries. And there's one at Brookwood in Surrey. That's one of the most interesting military cemeteries going. So they didn't bury them in pits, and I don't believe that story at all. I think it's apocryphal, as they say. People were aware that the soil had been disturbed, but then they bury the stuff. It's not like, for example, that they recovered all the bodies from the sea that were lost and then chucked them in there. They wouldn't do that. That's sort of how it worked in Bosnia. They stick people in pits. I know, all the research says that two or three of the people that were killed in that attack by U-boats at Slapton were bigots, and they're the ones that had the briefcases with the invasion plans on them, which were then chained to their belts. So there was a great effort to return to find and recover all the bigots. Certainly the UK, we've taken bodies back out to sea, and in Brixham in Devon, when HMS Formidable was lost, there was 547 died as a result of that torpedoing. And they started coming in to the local Coast Guard station, Key, and chucking the bodies in. And when the bodies reached the roof of the sort of boathouse, they just said to the fishermen, take them back out and throw them over. We haven't got room to store them. So it has been done. But, there were no body pits in my mind in Slapton.
Did you form any opinion as to how the evacuees were treated? The people who had to quit their farms and perhaps sell their livestock very quickly. Were they compensated? Was this a story you followed?
Well, there was. I think they were shabbily treated in the way they were moved out. There were some strenuous efforts to protect things like the church windows and things like that. But at least they managed to be allowed back in to the village afterwards. Not like the one on Salisbury Plain where the people, and I think there was another one in Dorset where the people were removed and never allowed back. But a lot of the buildings were damaged by shell fire, and there was the famous hotel on the east side of Slapton Lay, which had been destroyed in the gunfire that came ashore. And for someone who's interested in military history like myself, I left the army in August 1976, mm-hmm. came and joined my parents in Brixham. And there'd been a heat wave that year. So I went to Slapton Lay because I'd heard that things were being uncovered. And the river feeding the Slapton Lay, the freshwater bit, had dried up. And as I walked along that, there were US soldiers' webbing and weapons just lying in the puddles where they'd been lost as they fought their way across the fresh water bit. So it was interesting to see that. And they were always finding mines there as well, because you can never clear mines from a beach. And certainly in the... because I'd holidayed for about 20 years in Brixham before moving down there with my parents, and they were forever at Slapton having mines come up. Certainly all through the 60s, three or four mines every month would be noticed on the beach, and it's a shingle beach, quite large shingle. But then I seem to remember they came in and they did a very, very thorough search and got rid of loads and loads, declared it safe, but still occasionally they come up again. And of course it's not too far from Hall Sands, where they'd done the dredging to help build the dockyard breakwaters at Plymouth, which undermined all the seashore, and then the big storm came in and destroyed the houses at Hall Sands. So it's forever moving the surface of the of the beach.
Do you think the way that the Slapton story has been handled then is a bit sort of suspect? You know, in as much that these it's revealed as revelation and conspiracy theory and that. I wonder what your opinion of this. It seems that it was known a long time ago.
It was known about, and no one did anything about it. But then, yeah, and I'm not suggesting this of Ken Small at all, because Ken Small was genuinely interested. But there were so many people ready to make a quick buck out of these sort of stories, and it's almost like flying saucers. It's the conspiracy theory. You've got a couple of things there. Anyone can conjecture whatever they like. And the dead can't sue. So I could say Winston Churchill was a raving homosexual who had a love affair with Stalin. And no action could be taken against me. So it's very easy for a bloke down the pub. Ooh, ah, he says, oh yeah, I remember them. They was digging them holes in there and they were filling them with bodies. He hasn't the foggiest idea. He might have been there at the time. He might have been the farmer's son. He doesn't know what was in there.
What was interesting about Brookwood Cemetery?
Well, I'd been, because I'd when I ended up at Aldershot, I stayed in the mess when I first was up there as a civil servant, and I met my future wife in the mess, who was a Queen's Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps, and I took an interest in collecting then nursing medals from the First World War, and came across an account that they'd uncovered, they cut back some of the undergrowth and uncovered a whole load of like a First World War nurse's plot. So I went over there to have a look, and what you actually have is a very nice US cemetery, and then you have cemeteries, mini cemetery, war cemeteries from just about every nation going. There's like a Parsi war cemetery, which I think is Persian. It's a Pakistani war cemetery, Czechoslovakian plot. You've got all the people that Polish cemetery, war cemetery in there. All there's Royal Hospital Chelsea plot there, of which there's a huge container for the ashes of Chelsea pensioners who've died, and then you've got the Victorian Cemetery, which is, you know, full of all sorts of generals and things like this. So it's, for the military historian, it's pretty pretty spectacular. It really is. And the US cemetery, of course, they do things properly. They have attendants, and they have like a big room where you can go in, and there's all the registers on display, and then there's someone to talk to you about the cemetery and things like this. But then there's also a huge ex-serviceman's plot there. And at first glance, you look at these, and you think, oh, there's a war graves cemetery, and that goes on into the 50s and 60s and 70s. And I'd seen it again at Aldershot in the huge military cemetery there, which is creme de la creme of military ceremonies. Anyone can apply to get a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone for their ex-service relative. If they're so inclined, there might be a, you know, stalwart of the British Legion. But look at those headstones and you'll see there is a nick out of the top left and right hand corner. So it's a Commonwealth War Graves headstone, but where it would be circular at the top and then going straight down, there's a nick in there, and that constitutes being a private grave. A little known fact.
Yes, very, as you say, a topic in itself, isn't it? I would imagine you would spend a lot of time, you know, once you know these different aspects of it.
Well, people say, you know, do you have any hobbies? And I say, yes, I'm a student of funerary architecture. It's been a standing joke for years, but I understand the symbolism. But in terms of military graves, then I can read a cemetery ever so.
Have you ever looked at the issue of what's in coffins when they come back from wars?
Yeah, I'm aware that they often weight the coffins if there's not very much. And certainly one of my more unfortunate episodes was being taken to in Bosnia to see a hole in the ground where a Royal Engineer was about to detonate some gathered in munitions, and it went off prematurely and threw bits of them all over the place. And there was, you know, little bits of his camouflage union uniform on the side and such like. And I feel sure that they would have awaited that coffin. But I was very interested because many years ago I came up here to look at the photographs from the First World War. And I met an interesting old attendant, for want of a better word.
In the Imperial War Museum?
Yeah, here in the annex. And he said to me, gosh, you're an unusually interesting person. Would you like to see the photographs of the selection of the bodies to choose the unknown warrior from the First World War? So, had a look at those. And I also remember this, and I don't think anyone has picked it up yet. So you might have heard it here second. He said, look at the people. And they were out on this battlefield. There was a whole load of other ranks in their best uniforms with spades and forks and picks and a sergeant major and such like, and some officers. And they were finding, you know, there might be a rifle stuck with a Tommy's helmet on it, and they were digging up the grave, and there's no badges or buttons and such like. We'll take this one. I think they took half a dozen, and then one of those was selected. But nearly every one of those doing the digging had an unusual crimson ribbon on their chest. It was Victoria Cross ribbon. And that's never come out anywhere. I've done nothing with the story, but if you look very carefully, they've all got or a high proportion of them are wearing the Victoria.
So they were very specially selected men. It's interesting that, because I know, you know, we're talking really in the week of Armistice Sunday, aren't we? You know, Remembrance Sunday. There was a programme, I know, on the Unknown Warrior. I don't know whether you heard it. But that certainly didn't come out. No,
there's been several books on it and articles, and it's never come out. But I think that's the big secret, sitting here.
Yes. So would this be sort of extra respect paid? Would that be the idea of it?
I think so. You know, because the king was taking a great interest in all the rest of it. You know, when they didn't just let anybody go out and dig up a few bodies.
Right. Well, could we now go on then to your first big job with the soldier? All this has been so interesting, Laurie, and I would think, you know, grist to your mill. This must, you know, you were very experienced, you know, as your reporter and a photographer for the Soldier magazine. Is that right?
No, I was a reporter. No, I was an assistant editor. and effectively a feature writer.
Assistant editor and a feature writer.
And we always had a photographer working with us. But because I'd been a photographer as well, on the occasion there wasn't a photographer, then my photos would be used. Which would meant, for example, during the Gulf War, I was out there with a photographer, but I took my own cameras everywhere. And I documented everything. Now, while the soldier photographer would, for example, be lining up a number of troops in a happy smiling group next to a tank, I'd be looking beyond that and sort of recording history. And I think that's very interesting. As a formation sign, you know, the desert rats in North Africa during the war, well, the Africa Corps had stenciled on their vehicles like a little palm tree. Well, I came across one unit that had Andy Capp stencils. Andy Capp with his cap on, with a pint in his hand, staggering along, and that was on the mudguard of every vehicle. So I was documenting that. And for example, when I used to give slideshows around the south of the country after the Gulf War, I'd show people of an armoured vehicle, a scimitar, approaching through the desert and say, you know, what's unusual about that? And they say, I don't know. And I say, well, look just at the underneath of the front of the vehicle, and there's a succession of red stripes, vertical stripes. And they say, yes, what's that mean? And I said, look in front of the vehicles. And it was a desert, but there were like tuffets in this particular area of the desert. And in those tuffets lived snakes. And when they heard the rumble of these vehicles, they stuck their heads up to see what was coming, and hence the red stripes. So this is the really unusual minutiae of campaigns that I was documenting, as well as the sort of you know, wrecked vehicles and bodies and things like this. The things that people wouldn't normally have been photographing. And I came back with 3,500 colour slides alone of the all aspects of the war.
So getting this commission, first of all, was that difficult? Because I understand, and it would be interesting to get your point of view, that the, I suppose, the, if I call it the First Gulf War, is that legitimate? You know,
yes, it's Gulf War 1
1991,
now,
yeah. That this was a very tightly controlled operation so far as media was concerned. Am I right in thinking that?
If you're a member of the media, yeah, because you were signed up, if you like. You were given your uniform, you were fed, you were provided with tents and someone to guard you and all the rest of it. And therefore you are very controlled. And one of the most interesting photos I think I've seen was when we went to see, before the war, a demonstration of Viper, which was a strange bit of gear that fired like a rocket with a pipe behind it, shot out across the desert, laid across the ground, and they detonate that, and that would explode all the mines within a large area around that. But the photo, I think, is lovely. It's looking the other way, and there's a whole load of armoured vehicles parked up, and they're absolutely smothered in media photographers who were all there to take photographs. They all would have taken the same photographs. But then they actually appointed official war correspondents, which meant there were lots of people who couldn't get up the front, who eventually, some of them did manage it, and they were known as unilateralists. They worked by themselves. But attached to the British forces was the media production centre, which was in the Div admin area, some way back from the main line. And each brigade had photographer, television cameraman, TV reporter, i.e. Martin Bell, up with them. and then their material will be handed by, if you like, dispatch rider and Land Rover and taken back.
So
but that in itself was really problematical, because Martin Bell, who was attached to 4 Brigade, he and his team got the most fantastic footage of the war, and there were these funny black and white checkered bags, which is what the film went into and the dispatches. They put it in the dispatch and it went round and round, and after the war was over and people weren't interested anymore, a guy turns up in the Land Rover and says, "Here we are, here's Martin Bell's stuff." Now, whether that was deliberate or not, I'm not sure. But it was interesting, as much as having got the people serving with the military and assuring them that they would be given every access to the fighting, the moment the war started, they imposed a blackout on the media. And you can imagine how impressed they were that they couldn't do anything. So all those who were unilateralists and not attached to the media could do what they want, but the remainder were in a blackout. And the main media, I don't believe, actually saw the troops set off. Whereas I, for example, with my soldier photographer, we had our own dedicated vehicle. But because we worked for the Ministry of Defence, we were trusted. And we were just given a Geneva Convention card, which said that we were civilians attached to a military field force and therefore to be treated as civilian prisoners of war if we were captured, and we'd drive around everywhere wherever we wanted. And I can remember going off, and we drove across the desert. We didn't have satellite navigation, and if you've seen the maps of where the British troops were, they had to be seen to be believed, because they were blank paper. There was no features. You know, how do you do that? And we used to do it because wherever the British troops were, they'd have their vehicles under the sand covered camouflage, but they'd have radio aerials up. We saw a radio aerial, then we'd drive towards it. We came along, and then we suddenly realised the great lines of troops over to the left. And we waited, and someone said, you know, "Forward ho," like they did in the old cowboy films with the cavalry. And they drove across in front of us into a sandstorm, and then they went into Iraq, which was fantastic to be able to see that, photograph it. And
you had a tremendous advantage over this sort of the embedded people.
Yeah.
I know that word probably...
Privilege,
was it? Not later, it's embedded, isn't it? Those who
it became, they started calling them embedded, but not in the first Gulf War. But that was nearly the end of the my reporting forever, because having moved on from there, I saw an interesting U.S. convoy with these great big guns on the back of tracked chassis. And we went to get some photographs of those because we hadn't seen them. And we were sort of hanging around and thinking, you know, should we hang around? Will they move off? And we decided, no, we'll drive off. And we just drove over the hill when there was an earth-shattering explosion. And one of their trucks full of ammunition detonated on a bump right where we'd been. So we stayed clear of the Americans after that.
What sort of protection did you wear? Did you have, you know, flat jackets, helmets with your uniform?
It wasn't... That's where a bit of confusion comes in. You know, people in the military don't wear flak jackets. At the time, they brought in a thing called combat body armour. And it was like, you know, a reasonably flexible substance inside a cloth cover, which was designed purely to stop shell fragments, splinters, not bullets as such. And then they ultimately developed stuff with a ceramic plate which went over the heart and one behind, which was what the people wore a lot in Northern Ireland after that, you know, stopped sniper bullets and such like. But at the time it was there to stop shell splinters. But I think people have been so depressed that they, you know, so many people thought they were going to die anyway, because the sort of day before the battle, people were briefed as to what they would face, which people have been in the army for years and never had that sort of experience before. And I said to my photographer, Mike, I said, you wait here, I'll do the morning session. So I wandered across and sat down, and they had medics and people like that who said, right, we're going to tell you what it's going to be like, give you some idea. If there's chemical weapons, you know, you will see people who haven't got their gas masks on in time, and their face masks were just filled with yellow vomit as they're dying in front of you. Don't do anything to try and help them until you've got yourself sorted out. Ignore anyone dying around you. As you go through into Iraq, your own vehicle might be run over a mine and you're injured. They're marked in lanes. Everyone will have these funny little light sticks where you break them and they have a glow. Drag the injured to where the white tape is, break a stick, put it on their chest, leave them behind. But we warn you now, there's a danger they're going to get run over by armoured vehicles anyway. So having had all this, and I came back across the desert looking so depressed, and Mike, the photographer, said, what on earth happened? I said, you're not going to believe it. And he was laughing, and he said, you're kidding me, you're kidding me, you're winding me up, you know, stop winding me up. Ha, 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 he went off in the afternoon, and I sat there in my little desert chair, and I saw him come back a great big long face as well. But we were lucky because, you know, it didn't work like that. The worst thing we hit when we went into Iraq was the Channel 4 television's satellite dish bowl, which had fell off the vehicle in front, and I ran straight over it. Wasn't going to go off the track and hit a mine, so I ran over it. This bloke was searching for days for whoever it was that had run it over. And eventually I found out that he actually wanted to thank them, because since it had been run over, it had never worked so well.
End of Reel 2, Laurie Manton.